Around the beginning of the war in Iraq, I was channel surfing on a Sunday morning, and nestled among all the infomercials, I came upon a woman making a lot of sense about Iraq, the Middle East, U.S. foreign policy, and our role in the world. I was lucky enough to tune in at that top of an hour of a long interview between Tim Russert and today's guest, Robin Wright, five-time Pulitzer Prize nominee, and at that time, the chief diplomatic correspondent of the L.A. Times, now with the Washington Post. And at the end of the hour, I wished our nation's decision makers were asking her advice, and I committed to having her as my guest, and we did that in 2003. This is 2008, and I believe that Wright's experiences and perspective is as valuable now as ever. Her new book, Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East, draws on 35 years of reporting through wars, revolutions, and uprisings, as well as the birth of new democracy movements and a new generation of activists in 24 countries. She says of Dreams and Shadows, this is a book about disparate experiments with empowerment in the world's most troubled region. My goal was to probe deep inside societies of the Middle East for the emerging ideas and players that are changing the political environment in ways that will unfold for decades to come. In a New York Times review, Patrick Colburn writes, Wright has long been one of the best informed American journalists covering the Middle East, and her reputation is borne out here. She is refreshingly skeptical of conventional wisdom about what is happening in the region, and her book will be essential reading for anybody who wants to know where it is heading. Robin Wright has reported from more than 130 countries on six continents for numerous news organizations, including the Sunday Times in London, CBS News, Washington Post, Christian Science Monitor, New York Times, New Yorker, Atlantic Monthly, Foreign Policy, International Herald Tribune. She was one of the first journalists to write about the emergence of Mideast terrorism and Islamic extremism, which she's covered since the 70s. She won the 1989 National Magazine Award for reporting from Iran for The New Yorker, and her latest book is Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Our interview will air in two parts, in part one today. Welcome again, Robin Wright.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Thank you. I always like to begin with letting folks know a little bit about the people behind the books and the ideas and the work. So how did you become a writer, and why in a country whose people and whose media is not that interested in the rest of the world go so deeply into the globe, the world around us?
I'm a journalist by accident. I tripped into it when I was in college when a friend suggested I join the student paper, and I did, but I wrote sports. And I had a column my senior year called Broadside, which you couldn't get away with today.
Right.
And one of my first big scoops was at the Rose Bowl my senior year when they never allowed a woman reporter into the press box, and I broke the gender barrier. They tried to turn me away, but I had an exclusive on the fact that the Michigan football coach, Bo Schembechler, had a heart attack that morning. And I sent a note into the boys, and I said, I've got the story of the day, but alas, they won't let me in. And bless their altruistic hearts, they got up and walked out, and I made my first little bit of history. And I had always interest in foreign affairs. I went to a school in Europe as a when I was in high school, and enjoyed the sense of meeting and living with foreign students who were also we gathered from dozens of nations, and I became very involved in trying to understand Africa and the Middle East particularly, and I've lived in both parts of the world. I ended up in the Middle East again by coincidence. I was on my way to Iran in October 1973 and landed in Beirut on the day the Fourth Middle East War broke out, and I've since covered every war in the region and a lot of other ones, to the point that my father once said he wouldn't go to Bermuda with me on vacation because there'd surely be a coup d'etat. Every time I land someplace, there's trouble.
That's right. I guess someone could have joked that about Grenada at one point and turned out to be right. I think the reason that I was really looking forward to your new book is that I'm dismayed by the tendency among Americans and among American media to view Islam or Muslims or the countries of the Middle East and so on in some sort of monochromatic, stereotypical thing, the worst sort of at that end being, you know, Islamo-fascism and that sort of thing. And I thought, here's someone who I know has made the purpose of this book is to see what the seedlings are, what the shoots are of reform, religious, which some people don't know exists at all, reform within Islam, and reform in the political nature of the Middle East. As using the American stereotype as the backdrop, what's the reality?
Well, the reality is this is one of the most diverse blocks of country in the world. Over 22 nations, they stretch across two continents, from Rabat in North Africa to Tehran on the Persian Gulf. And they include many, they're not all Muslims, they include many minorities. 10% of Egypt is Coptic Christian. A quarter of the Palestinians are diverse Christian sects. There are 17 recognized religious groups in Little Lebanon, which is 1,000 square miles smaller than Connecticut. You have the diversity of men who wear white robes in Saudi Arabia and women who wear black cover and sometimes up to 4 layers of veil. And a few hundred miles away, you have Lebanon, where the women wear the sassiest, sexiest bikinis you've ever seen, and men wear their brief little Speedos, all on the same beach. So it's not as if there is one image, one way of life, or even one religion. There are diverse ethnic groups. Think of the Kurds, the largest minority in the world without a state, span several countries in the region. And they're not all Muslim either. There are Jewish Kurds. So there's greater diversity in the region. I've translated between a Moroccan and a Saudi who didn't understand each other's Arabic. And so I used my French and English to help them understand each other.
Okay, so that just sets the big picture, as I said. Now, I quoted Patrick Colburn's review in the intro, but I'm also going to quote what he wrote later, which I'm sure you know what's coming. She claims there is a budding culture of change, represented by defiant judges in Cairo, rebel clerics in Tehran, satellite television station owners in Dubai, imaginative feminists in Rabat, and the first female candidates in Kuwait. Young techies in Jeddah, daring journalists in Beirut and Casablanca, and brave writers and businessmen in Damascus. Sadly, he says, her own research largely contradicts this thesis. Of the many opponents of the status quo she writes about, the only ones to have achieved a measure of success are religious movements, Hamas in Gaza and the West Bank, and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Again, the big picture of reform and change. And what I'd like you to answer in this was, when you started the book, what did you, you know, expect, and you know, how did, what's the reality that you confronted in the time you wrote it?
Well, I think he's right in a way. The reality is that this is just a beginning, and that's the only thing I'm trying to argue. That what we've begun to see is people carving out new political space, defying the autocrats. We are not going to find change coming from the top in any Middle East country. And therefore, whatever happens next is going to be from grassroots movements, people who take the initiative themselves. It's often going to involve Islamist movements. It's the full range of activists. In this book, which has both the dreamers and the shadows, I went to also see the heads of Hezbollah and Hamas, those who have limited change, who continue to engage in extremist tactics. But I thought the one of the most important reasons to write a book about the contemporary Middle East, looking ahead, is because we understood as a nation so little about what was going on inside Iraq that we made a horrendous series of mistakes. And we relied on exiles, the leader of whom had not been to Iraq since 1958 when he was a teenager, Ahmed Chalabi. And so I wanted to look at who are the actors inside these countries. What's the direction? Where are they headed? And I agree that many of them are only nudging the door open, but it's open for the first time in almost every country. That even the leaders, as the new human rights report for the past year concludes, that even the leaders who are not committed to democracy have adopted the language of democracy because they know that's what people want. Now, I'm not naive enough to believe we're going to see democracies in, you know, any kind of Western form in the region anytime soon, maybe even ever. But I think there are people who do want to take some control over their lives, do want to allow participation, do want economic opportunity, do want some sense of social justice or equality for all the peoples in their country. And some of them are doing incredibly brave things. I tried to look for the new Lech Walesas, the new Nelson Mandelas. We've gone through a period of change over the last 30 years throughout the world with the demise of communism in Eastern Europe, the collapse of apartheid and minority rule in Africa, the end of military dictatorships in Latin America. And the people of the region are very aware of what's happened elsewhere, and they don't want to be excluded. Courtesy of modern technology, the information age, the internet, satellite television, they are aware of globalization and the forces that are reshaping the world, and they don't want to be excluded. Now, it's going to take a long time, but look at the Soviet Union. Now that it's Russia, we still have a reformed communist as a president a generation later, succeeded by a handpicked ally. So democracy is not born easily anywhere. Thomas Jefferson, in one of the epigrams I have in the book, says democracy is not born on a featherbed. And that's so true.
Speaking of that, we've referred to the book a couple of times, Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Where did the title come from?
Oh, a quotation from Ataturk. And I'd have to look at it. But it's he talks about dreams and shadows that and the ideas in the region and the challenge of trying to reshape a part of the world. Ataturk, of course, was the great modernizer of Turkey. And Turkey, in many ways, is an example of what the Middle East is aspiring to, a country that has, at the moment, even has an Islamist party in power, but wants to be part of the European Union and wants to bridge the gap. And I think there are vast numbers in the region who want something similar. The interesting thing I've found is that so many people are rejecting the extremism of Al-Qaeda, that this had its appeal at one point because it said no to autocrats. But in the meantime, it has provided no constructive alternatives. It's only destructive. And people in the region have the same concerns that everyone else does about job opportunity, education, housing, a sense of hope and prosperity down the road. And Al-Qaeda doesn't provide that for any of them. And so even in a place like Iraq, the one U.S. success has come from the tribal sheikhs who have turned against Al-Qaeda. It was no fault of ours, or credit to us, but it was saying, we don't want you to rule and impose your strict way of life. We're tired of you killing our fathers, our uncles, our wives, our children. And they've mobilized not only an awakening council in Anbar, but they've mobilized 90,000 people to serve in police and military units in Anbar province, once the most volatile. That doesn't mean Iraq is going to be a success. We're very lucky that these people took the initiative. But it just proves my point.
Just one example of that turning against, yet that the expression of anger and frustration and rage and so on only goes so far. I think at this point what I'd like to do is look around, as you do in the book, at different countries. We're not going to cover all of them, but let's start, as you do, with Palestine, and we'll finish, as you do, with Iraq. Palestine, it's interesting even to see, I'm going to say this, even to see a chapter or two that are just about Palestine and not about Palestine and Israel. In other words, the fact that you even treat it as an entity is so seldom the case.
Well, I wanted to look at the region beyond the things that absorb us, Iraq, Al-Qaeda, or Arab-Israeli. I wanted to look inside societies to get a sense of what's happening among the people themselves. The Palestinian chapter was interesting because I decided to frame the whole chapter in terms of brothers to show the diversity within the region. And there are two particular stories. One involves two brothers, one who came from a refugee family. One ended up going to Columbia, getting his PhD in political science, came back to the region, formed the first independent Arab political research organization, worked with his Israeli counterparts during the early days of the peace process, the Oslo Accord, trying to get a sense of public opinion among Palestinians. What were they really willing to accept?
I know one thing he says, by the way, is how difficult it was to do the first polls, that it took them I think months even, to get people to begin to answer questions.
Yeah, they were very reluctant. But, you know, and he has a co-appointment at Brandeis University. So he really works both sides of the Israeli-Arab divide. His brother went to a university in Egypt, which had a strong Islamic student movement. He qualified as a doctor, went back to Gaza, and formed Islamic Jihad, which is the most militant of the anti-Israeli groups. And so you had this extraordinary diversity in one family. I was there for the Palestinian election in January 2006 and met the second set of brothers, who were very interesting, the Rajoubs. And one of them had been Yasser Arafat's chief security advisor, and he'd worked closely with the CIA. Boasted about it, had pictures with George Tenet that he liked to show people, lived the high life, had, you know, his armor-plated limousines, and he was running for parliament. His brother was also running for parliament on the Hamas ticket, a religious sheikh. And so, again, we tend to think, as you pointed out at the beginning of this conversation, the monolithic nature. And the diversity within societies, even within families, is really stunning. In the early 21st century.
So, and I appreciate the fact that you tell it through stories, and feel free when I ask a question that sounds like a policy question, if you want to answer it with a human story, that's definitely fine by me. So, what we see is what we see through those two stories is the range of change. Now, what also happens, right, is that the very cocky security guard who's been in power all his life or his adult life doesn't even make it to parliament.
Yeah, there were nine candidates. The top nine candidates in from that district won seats in parliament. His brother got the first number, came in number one, and he didn't even come up in the top nine. You know, we tend to, in the outside world, look at that election in terms of just Hamas's victory. But there was something else that happened there that was quite interesting, and that was that people rejected a party that had dominated for a half century. And so it marked change. Many people voted for Hamas, not to vote for Hamas, but to vote against something, a party that had been corrupted, was not delivering, where it had become a kind of oligarchy. And of course, many who voted for Hamas didn't even anticipate that Hamas would win. It changed the dynamics completely. But that's what happens during transitions. A lot of unexpected things happen. Transitions are tough and turbulent.
Yeah, one thing that I noticed, someone says it in there, and as I thought back, it seems so often to be the case, because it was the case in Iran, it was the case in Russia, you know, that the first people who take or the what seems to have won the revolution often is a quick transition to something else, right? In other words, and that's jumping from Palestine, but this idea that revolutions have transitions, and let's not pretend they don't. But let's continue with Palestine for a second. So, and I'm going to link it to Iran's election, actually, not its revolution. But it looked to me that what happened with the election of Hamas in Palestine and the election of Ahmadinejad in Iran is that the people voted against corruption. And if we, the West, back the corrupt and then say, here's democracy, this is kind of a recipe for exactly that happening, isn't it?
Very, very good point. And I'm so grateful that you actually read the book, which you clearly have. But it is striking. I mean, the same thing happened in Iran, that people were tired of the clerics, that whole generation of revolutionaries who had been corrupted, who were in many ways more corrupt than even the monarchy had been. And people used to say they paid a bribe once, and now you pay a bribe at every single level. And people voted against a man who'd been president before, President Rafsanjani, running 8 years after the time he left for office. And people were saying no to the clerics themselves, that for the first time they elected someone who'd not been a cleric. Who there's this debate about the turban versus the hat in Tehran when it comes to politics, and they elected the first one who wore a hat. And again, it was not a vote for him. He'd been mayor of Tehran for 2 years. Nobody really knew who he was.
Which, by the way, is an appointed position.
That's
so he'd
right.
never run for political office.
That's right. He'd been appointed a governor earlier, came from the Revolutionary Guards. Iranians really didn't know what they were getting into.
They were voting against the status quo. Against, I mean, it's interesting that I say corruption, it's also autocracy in both these cases, that they vote against corrupt autocratic regimes, which is what you would hope they would do.
And the message is, we want something different. We're going to vote for something different, and we're going to get out and vote. And the Palestinian election was the freest and fairest ever held in the Arab world.
We want democracy. We want elections. And we can see that the folks we've been backing are corrupt. It seems to – I mean, what my thought was, you know, well, you got to do your homework. You've got to find some way to support something that the people will support. You can't tell them what to do. That's the trick with democracy. But if you keep putting the old against the new, they may vote against the old and vote in something else. What could we be doing?
Well, I think the lesson of Iraq is we're going to have to stand back. It's not just an issue of not using military force. It's that any time we side with someone, people are going to be suspicious of what our ulterior motives are. Because there were no weapons of mass destruction, because there was no al-Qaeda presence in Iraq, people are suspicious of why we engage. Many are convinced that it is because of America's need for oil. There are others who believe we want military bases in the Middle East. So in the future, we're going to have to often defer to them. But there are ways, I think, that we can use, whether it's our economic aid to some of these countries. Instead of giving it to governments, we can give it to the non-government organizations engaged in trying to better education or to help with informing people about how to run a campaign, to deal with health projects, to better life on the ground. So often, U.S. aid goes for military projects or security situations that are used not to help governments, but to help governments stay in power and repress their own people.
Right. It doesn't help governments as much as help those in government at
That's
the
right.
time, whoever they happen
That's
to be.
That's right.
Let's before we leave Palestine, what is the situation nowadays? And one thing that I'm going to mention is that one of the things that is often missed in the U.S. also is that Hamas, like Hezbollah, has at least two purposes. It has a wing that is a terrorist organization, and it has most of its activities actually that are social welfare. And that when people were voting for Hamas, they weren't voting for, you know, guesswork. They knew under the corrupt Fatah PLO regimes, the people were taken care of by Hamas. Can you speak just a little bit about that? And it strikes me that when you've got autocracy and they don't want political opposition, then the mosques are going to be where social welfare can happen because it doesn't seem like an enemy.
Well, and also because regimes have outlawed, executed so many of the liberal Democrats that the Islamist movements are left as the only idiom of political opposition. And they're credible and legitimate in the eyes of people who are Muslims. Islam is unique among the world's major monotheistic religions in that it offers a set of rules by which to govern a society as well as a set of spiritual beliefs. But the Islamist movements everywhere have emerged in context of a desperate need for social services, for things governments are not providing, and they fill a vacuum. And Hamas has done that, Hezbollah has done that, and that's why, as you point out, they have some credibility. The problem, of course, is they are never going to be acceptable to the outside world and to many of their own people until they renounce terrorism. Hamas is going to have to go through the same conversion that the PLO did in 1988, in recognizing Israel's right to exist and promising not to engage in terrorism, a pledge on the latter count that it is not always kept. But
you get interviews with the very top of Hamas.
I did. I went to Damascus.
And you ask, are you willing to do what Arafat did? And the leader says no.
The leader says no. He talks about what they call a hudna, which is it's a ceasefire, but it's not peace. And it's an open-ended ceasefire. And that's their alternative. Clearly, that's not acceptable to Israel, to the United States, or to the international community.
Yeah. I mean, as much as I've been sounding like I'm sort of saying, well, let's look more openly at this. Another side of this question to me is If one side in a negotiation says that the other side has no right to exist and that we our goal is to destroy you, can you really negotiate on those terms?
No. And the tragedy is that the United States pushed harder than the Israelis or the Palestinians for that 2006 election because we thought this was a way of entrenching the rule of the post-Arafat leadership, not understanding that people might vote against it because it had failed to deliver. And now achieving peace is going to be far more complicated than it was 2 years ago.
Right. If I gave you 1 minute, what's your take right now on the Bush administration's attempts, Condoleezza Rice's attempts, and so on?
I've traveled with secretaries of state since Henry Kissinger trying to make peace in the Middle East, and we've made some important progress. But I don't think there is enough momentum, enough energy, or enough ideas on the table to achieve something tangible by the end of the Bush administration. It would take a small diplomatic miracle, maybe even a large one, to pull it off.
So we might end up just as we did at the end of the Clinton administration, playing catch up at the end and falling short and basically be back sort of where we were then?
The best we can probably hope for is to have some kind of framework agreed on and hoping that talks would continue into the next administration.
Right. Okay, so again, the book is Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. The website is robinwright.net. That's Robin, W-R-I-G-H-T, one word, .net. Thank you, Robin Wright. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.